Support comes from the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center, James Cancer Hospital, and Solove Research Institute. Just as no two people are exactly the same, neither are their cancers. At the OSU CCC James, there is no routine cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Demand for mental health services continues to grow across all the demographic groups, but nearly 8 out of 10 of the nearly 200,000 therapists at work in the U.S. are white, and little education and training about racial and immigration issues is provided for new therapists. That's frustrating for people of color who are looking for help from someone who understands their identity and life experiences. Noriel Armstrong is the CEO and director of A Therapist Like Me. It's an organization dedicated to matching individuals with a therapist who understands their identity. Welcome to the show.
Hello, good morning. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, I mean, why is therapy so lacking in diversity in the first place?
That's a great question. My answer would be that there was no space for people of color in the foundational development of therapy, just like many things, unfortunately, in this country. Counseling and the theories and theorists that we all study and all know are mostly older white males. As we progress into, I'm going to say the 1960s, 1970s, we started seeing theories pop up by women. You have the relational cultural theory, you have feminist model, you have other thoughts that have started to develop that hone and take the perspective of women. And now you get into the 1990s, early 2000s, we're starting to see more theories and ideas develop that are based off of cultural models and different cultural backgrounds, but it's still very new. Counseling itself really honestly is new when you think from philosophy to psychology to then counseling. We're kind of like the grandchild of philosophy, and so we're still pretty young ourselves. So getting to that point where we're being more culturally responsive is an ongoing process.
So if I'm a patient and I'm with a therapist who's not my gender or not, doesn't share enough common denominators, I guess is one way to put it. And I tell them, I just don't feel like you know enough about how I live to talk to me. What's the typical argument a therapist will give back, or what should you be looking for in a therapist in terms of a response?
Great question again. Client should be looking for in a therapist is someone who is culturally competent. And I will say that our pedagogy, our educational foundation, we do have the incorporation of multicultural counseling courses. There are gender courses. There are some courses specifically designated to working with people with disabilities. There's rehabilitation counseling that deals with helping people who have had injuries or had issues where they need rehabilitation counseling. So there is this part within our profession where we are training students to be as culturally competent as possible. There takes a lot of work outside of the classroom. So there's only so much we can teach in a 15-week semester. And some of the classes go for a couple of semesters, but a lot of the work we encourage our students to go outside of the classroom. So to immerse yourself in different cultures in your community, visit different churches, visit different community centers, expand your knowledge and your interactions personally so that you have an understanding of your client's possible worldview. And in session, it is our job as the counselor to broach that conversation. So it is our job because, in all honesty, we hold power in the room as the person, the therapist. So it's our responsibility to address that if we see it as a need. So it would be my responsibility as a therapist to say, you know, I'm noticing that I'm a heterosexual female and you are a transgender male, and there might be some concerns that there's some issue in the room where there's some conflict in the room. Let's talk about that. And then have an honest, genuine conversation with the client. And if the client at the end doesn't feel comfortable, then it's also my responsibility to help put them in contact with a therapist who can meet their needs and be that bridge for them.
But there's a huge shortage on whenever you're a marginalized part of a marginalized community, there's going to be a shortage. There's a shortage generally anyways. So that is a struggle.
Yes, it definitely is. Your statistic that you gave at the beginning of this interview, I was like, yep, exactly. That is something that we in the profession, especially those of us that are therapists from historically marginalized communities, we talk about often. We are working to try to get more students interested in counseling, to get more people interested in counseling, to really understand what counseling is different from psychology or different from psychiatry or even different from human resources and human resource counseling. And so there's a lot of education that has to go on in the communities that we serve so that they have a better understanding, but also young boys and girls who want to go into different professions, you know, may not consider counseling because they don't know a lot about it or know what steps they need to take. So one of our things is helping to increase education, but there is a shortage. And recently with COVID, there's been this increase, which on the one hand, it's a good thing. More people have noticed and realized, you know, maybe counseling isn't so bad. Maybe I need to talk to someone. Mm-hmm. But the downside to that is more people of color, more people from marginalized communities are seeking therapy, but it's hard to find someone who shares a similar identity or similar shared experiences. And so we have therapists who are backdated or backlogged and have a waiting list and a pretty extensive waiting list. And unfortunately, until we have more students going through programs that come from these historically marginalized communities, we're going to continue to see these waiting lists.
There's also, I mean, we've talked about it on the show before, the what's the word I'm searching for? Taboo or anti-counseling attitudes in the African-American community traditionally. I think obviously that's changing, but how much do you think that plays a role in people's maybe disinterest in going into the field?
I think historically, you know, it plays a major role because there is it has gotten better, but there is that distrust from the medical profession and from those surrounding the medical profession. So although we are maybe on the outside circle of the medical profession, we still are professionals who have power. And coming from a marginalized group of people who normally have not had the power and have been oppressed by the people with power, there is this distrust that, well, I don't want to tell you my business, or I don't want to tell you what's going on. You might call CPS, or you might tell me I have to move out of my apartment, or whatever. There's this fear and distrust. I can say that many therapists of all backgrounds have worked really hard to help dissuade this distrust and show members of marginalized communities that, no, we are not going to turn you in. This is what it means to come to counseling. There is this confidentiality piece. Your information is privileged. There are instances where we might have to break that confidentiality, and we share that with clients. But it definitely has played a role in people of Black communities, Hispanic, other BIPOC communities wanting to reach out, and other marginalized groups because of that power differential. But again, I am seeing it change. We are seeing the numbers increase. We are seeing more people understanding that it's not about being judged. It's not about getting in trouble. Counseling is really about getting that support you need to be as well as you possibly can be from day to day.
Nouriel Armstrong, are you satisfied with the level of recruitment into the profession? You know, across, you know, outside of the, you know, white male.
Somewhat, I'll say somewhat. I teach here in West North Carolina. I've taught at two different universities, and by far the number of students are outweighed by white students compared to students of other colors, and also of other gender orientation, other disabilities, other marginalized community groups. And I would like to see that change. I would like to see there being more recruiting going on in the high schools, even starting at as young as junior high, when they have career days. I don't remember seeing too many people there saying, oh, I'm a counselor. Here's what's awesome about this career. And so I would love to see us going into the schools more especially schools in rural areas or low socioeconomic areas, and talking about A, just telling what counseling is, and then B, telling them, okay, these are some of the avenues that you can go with the counseling degree. And that's one thing I don't think we do enough of, is sharing just how many avenues. I'm a teacher, I'm a professor, I'm a counselor, I'm a supervisor, I can do consultation. So having my degree in counseling has allowed me to have a lot of different avenues and ways of making a living for myself, and making a darn good living for myself. But we don't talk about that side of it. And so I feel like if we got in there and talked about our profession more and all the things that you can do with this profession, we would gain more interest from students and children of marginalized, historically marginalized communities, to get them into the programs, to then get them out and being therapists.
You know, I read that the stressors of the pandemic that drove so many people to finally get counseling that they probably needed in the first place or wanted, has also had a disproportionate impact on therapists, counselors of color, and from marginalized communities, that they've borne the brunt of it harder than your typical white male therapist.
Correct. Exactly. There has been this influx and this increase, which we are, on the one hand, excited to see, because this is what we want. We want people reaching out and getting help instead of holding on to their hurts and their pains and their struggles. However, counseling costs, and it is not cheap. And there are those who can't afford to pay the full price. There are some clients who don't have insurance, or they have insurance, but their insurance isn't covered. We're not on their panels, or their insurance doesn't cover mental health support, which is another thing that we as counselors are lobbying for, is that more insurance companies provide insurance for mental health counseling and mental health services. And so you end up having these clients who come knocking at your door, and you understand why, and you have a heart for them, and you want to support them, but you also want to make a living. And so if you offer a sliding scale, or if you offer discounted prices, then are you able to keep your doors open? Are you able to pay your bills, because you're wanting to help everyone, but you also have to charge what your market rate is so that you can afford to pay your rental space or pay your light bills, and then have your own personal outside of your office expenses to take care of. So it really is a slippery slope, because you want to help and as much as you can. And although we are required to do so many sessions as pro bono, and we do have the option to do a sliding scale, if the majority of your clients are not paying your market rate, then you're not seeing a profit. And that's unfortunate. And so there's this kind of thin line that we walk a lot of times as therapists of color, trying to meet the needs of the community, but also meet our personal needs. And so finding agencies that offer free services or discounted services are really helpful. But oftentimes those agencies are white run, and the therapists are white who are doing the therapy. And so it's kind of this like, yeah, it's free, but you're not going to get someone who maybe fully understands. There are therapists out there who are working hard to be more culturally competent, but sometimes it just feels easier and more comfortable to sit aside and across from somebody who shares some very similar and visible identities or intersections that you do.
How does a therapist like me match people with therapists?
So, great question. It's not so much that we match them. Okay. We have the directory, and on the directory, it's free for therapists from historically marginalized communities to be on our directory. We don't charge. And there they can list all of their information, where they're located, how to contact them, their populations that they work with. And so when we go out to events, or we're in communities, churches, when we advertise the directory. And so if you are a client of color who is part of the LGBT community, you can go to the directory, and we have the directory divided out by those intersections. So race, religion, sexual orientation, gender, disability. So when you click on disability, you'll see all the therapists who A, may themselves have a disability, but also have specific training working with clients with disabilities. So then you're able to go in there and specifically look at therapists who have that particular intersection. And then you can do the same for religion. You can do the same for race. So that's how we kind of make it easier for you to find somebody who's like, oh, that's a transgender therapist. Oh, let me see what they bring to the table. And so it just kind of narrows the field for you. And then once you're able to do that, if they are also a voucher member, meaning they accept our vouchers, and you need financial support, then you can apply for our voucher program. And it's a blind review. We review each person's application. They have to submit their financial support or some financial records, so we know the need is there. And once we score all the rubrics, then we can say, yes, you've been afforded this amount that you requested. And so then they can get financial support to help pay for the therapy. So it's a two-pronged process.
And are you national or are you regional, or how does it work?
So right now we're just state. We're just in North Carolina. Our board recently voted to do regional. And so we're hoping to kick that off in 2023. We're making plans now as we wrap up this year, with 1 month left. We're making plans on making sure the liability insurance, the counseling compact, because in order for you to see a client, you have to be licensed in that state. So we're just trying to make sure our T's are crossed and our I's are dotted, that the therapists that we may add on the directory have the ability to see clients in different states, or make it very clear, I'm only a therapist for clients in Georgia. I'm only a therapist for clients in Virginia. So we're just trying to get all the pieces of the puzzle laid out, so that hopefully in the new year we can launch and be regional. Our goal, we would love to be national, or at least if not national, have like a therapist like me west, and have the people in California doing something similar. So we've had those conversations as well. So we are definitely looking forward to and planning on growing this business.
I wondered if you have counterparts in other states that are trying to do the same sort of thing.
As far as I know, we have not come across any as of yet that are doing the exact same thing. There are agencies there that are paying for therapy. So like you apply for maybe support, but they don't have the directory where there's the intersections, or they have that, but they don't have the voucher. So we see kind of like similar, but not quite the same. But that is one conversation that we have had, is like, hey, what would it look like if we got together with therapists on the West Coast, and we worked with gave them our model, mm-hmm. showed them how it worked, and then they had, you know, a therapist like me west, or however we wanted to do it. So a lot of ideas brewing. We have a great board. We have great therapists that are on our directory who are very active with wanting to see the organization continue to grow. So we are looking forward to what's next.
Noriel Armstrong, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Great questions. And I appreciate having this time to kind of share and talk about it.
Me too. That's Noriel Armstrong. She is CEO and director of A Therapist Like Me. It's an organization that matches individuals. Well, maybe match is not the right word, but connects people with a therapist who understands their identity, whatever that might be. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A drug used to treat diabetes also suppresses appetite and craving. That's made the off-label use of Ozempic popular for weight loss therapy. But experts are worried about shortages to treat diabetes and unintended side effects as a weight loss strategy. Dr. Disha Narang is an endocrinologist at Northwestern Medicine Lake Forest Hospital. She specializes in obesity and culinary medicine. Dr. Narang, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So what is Ozempic and how does it work?
Yeah, so Ozempic is in the category of medications called GLP-1 agonists. We've been using these medications for about a decade or so. And initially, the treatment started for our patients with diabetes, and it would help to control blood sugars. It would help with controlling cravings and aid with weight loss as well. So that would actually really help with improving patients' insulin needs or actually decreasing the insulin needs. And so as we've kind of gone on through this last decade, there have been approvals now for liraglutide, which is a daily injectable, and semaglutide, which is a weekly injectable, and that's Ozempic or Wegovy. And we have approval for weight loss for those medications now as well.
So what is the concern about the shortage? Because if you're taking something for weight loss, chances are you're probably pre-diabetic, if not diabetic.
You know, so the Ozempic is indicated for patients with type 2 diabetes only, whereas Wegovy, which is still semaglutide, so it's the same medication, that's indicated for weight management. Now, we've had a shortage of Wegovy since about last year, so it's been a full year for the of shortage for that, and now we're seeing these shortages of Ozempic as well. So what's happening is that oftentimes Ozempic is prescribed what we say is off-label for potentially weight management and/or prediabetes or diabetes. And so what we've seen in the last several months is unprecedented demand for the medication. You know, just there has been a lot more publicity about it in the last several months.
Yeah, because now that it's approved, they can advertise it that way, right?
So Ozempic is still approved for type 2
Okay.
diabetes.
But it who so who's pushing it?
Yeah, so we're seeing a lot of traction on social media with, you know, TikTok, Instagram, et cetera. We are seeing a lot of people on social media talking about the medication, and it has really created a lot of publicity around it. And now, you know, I do diabetes management and I do weight management. And so certainly these medications have been game changing in terms of our management of both chronic conditions. The one issue to really emphasize is that weight and obesity are chronic diseases, just like diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. And so it needs to be treated as such. And so the one issue is that, you know, using this kind of medication for just a short term, like, you know, a month or two in order to get ready for certain events or, you know, those kinds of things, that's not necessarily the purpose or intention of the medication. When we treat patients for weight management with these medications or diabetes, the intention is that they're going to be on it for a longer period of time, just like we treat for something like diabetes or blood pressure. It's a chronic treatment.
Do they not work as well if you are looking at it on a short-term basis versus long-term?
So patients may achieve some weight loss in that short amount of time, but what may actually happen is that they regain the weight just as quickly once they stop the medication. And so it's not necessarily, you know, a trend that you or a fad that you would use for a couple months or a couple weeks and you're off of it and you're set. This is something that, you know, people need to think about again as a chronic treatment that, you know, and the way I usually talk to my patients about it is that, you know, it may have taken 30 years to get to a certain weight or a certain level in the diabetes. So it's not going to change in the next 2 months, and you're not going to be down, you know, 50 pounds. That's just not the way it works. And the other thing that is often underscored is that conversation about how important lifestyle is as well. You know, we're not having these conversations about how important it is to maintain, you know, a healthy, moderate diet. We're not having these conversations about how to put various meals together, to improve our weight and diabetes control, how important it is to continue to exercise daily. So this is not necessarily the magic wand that it's being touted to be, and it's not. The way I phrase it is that it's usually the cherry on top to all your efforts.
You know, when I was preparing this morning, I asked one of my producers because it said she specializes in obesity and culinary medicine. And I'm like, is that really a thing? Obviously, we talk about food as medicine all the time.
Absolutely.
But anyone who's grown up in the system of medicine in the United States, really the traditional standard system, knows that if you go to a doctor and say, well, will it help if I change my diet? They're like, yeah, I don't know. That's changing, but really slowly.
Yeah, you know, and so here the issue behind that is that there's not really enough education about nutrition in medical school. And so even for me, a lot of this education has come post-medical school, but it's become an inherent part of my practice as well, because without that emphasis on how to eat or what to eat, all those other efforts, medications, all of those things are not as effective as one may like, right? And so in the studies where Wegovy was studied, where Ozempic was studied, the participants in those studies that were most successful with weight loss and diabetes control were those folks that really had an intensive lifestyle and a very focused lifestyle. And so, you know, one of the issues in just modern current medicine is that doctors often don't have enough time to address all of these issues. But I do think that it is important to really take the time, even if it's one clinical pearl or one tip, to really help folks start to change their habits, because that's inherently what we're trying to battle here. We can throw all the medications in the world at someone, but if that day-to-day lifestyle is not changing, or if someone's not really understanding how to eat or manage that part of it, it's tough.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. Disha Narang. She is an endocrinologist at Northwestern Medicine Lake Forest Hospital, and she specializes in obesity and culinary medicine. What's the difference between Ozempic and Wegovy?
There is no difference. So they're both semaglutide. Wegovy, the dose structure is a little bit different. The highest dose goes to 2.4, okay, whereas Ozempic goes to a 2 milligram dose max. But they're both semaglutide.
So when the FDA approves Wegovy, why isn't Ozempic also approved?
Yeah, that's probably above my pay grade a little bit. I think this comes down to some of the decisions made by the company that produces Wegovy and Ozempic. I think part of it is also to distinguish that one is for one purpose and the other is for another purpose.
Okay.
I think, you know, my opinion would be it probably would be easier to just use the same medication for both indications.
And so this push, and particularly the social media push for Ozempic, is that kind of a forbidden fruit kind of a thing, do you think? People think it must be better if the FDA won't approve it for obesity?
Not necessarily. Okay. It's I think it's just because Wegovy has been in short supply since the last year.
Okay.
And so nobody can really get their hands on it because, you know, the production is very much slowed. So Ozempic is sort of the fallback. And so, you know, because of that demand, it's having a downstream effect, you know, to the patients who really need to use it for their treatment of diabetes.
If you're not obese, maybe you just want to drop 10 pounds, whatever. Are there any dangers to using these drugs to lose weight short term?
You know, short term, I don't know how much success it will be. So you could certainly lose that weight in a short amount of time, but the weight regain following the discontinuation of the medication certainly could be there. So this is a chronic treatment, and it's not like a 2 month fad diet or 2 month medication that you take and that's the end of it. These medications work the best when we use it more long term.
The same company produces both medications, mm-hmm. right? Novo mm-hmm. Nordisk, and they say they're on track to combat the shortage, but this off-label use is an issue. What are physicians in your field saying about this? Are they getting pressure from their patients?
Every single day, we're seeing messages upon messages from patients saying that they can't find their medications at their local pharmacies. Patients are frustrated. You know, unfortunately, patients and then us are sort of in the middle because we're trying to figure out other alternatives to Ozempic, other GLP-1 agonists. But then those have also had that downstream effect where those are also now in shortage. And so we're definitely feeling, the push here in terms of trying to get these medications to our patients, because, you know, I've had patients whose diabetes have, you know, their blood sugars have gotten worse off the medications. Patients have regained weight since being off the medications. And so, you know, for the folks who are doing well on it, they're definitely, you know, struggling to either find an alternative. We're in contact with our representatives at the companies. And so, you know, we're trying to do our best, but, you know, we also are stuck in the middle a little bit here. So we are waiting anxiously for the supplies to be replenished so that we can get our patients their medication.
I was kind of interested in your approach to culinary medicine when you're talking to your patients about their lifestyle, how some of them respond and how well prepared you think you are to have what can sometimes be a tough conversation.
Absolutely. You know, so this is what I do for a living. So I'm very comfortable. I almost revel in those conversations because it's so needed. You know, what I notice is when most patients come into my clinic, they are often feeling shamed or just confused about, you know, their weight, or somebody else may have told them, you know, eat healthy and exercise. And a lot of people don't know what that means, because it may mean something totally different to one person versus another. It may depend on their resources that they have at home. Are they food insecure? Do they have, you know, the ability to cook? Do they know what to pick out at the grocery store? And so it really comes down to, you know, meeting them where they're at, understanding what their resources and abilities are, and going from there. You know, I'm not going to be able to tell somebody who potentially eats out 3 times a day to, hey, just start cooking at home and things will be fine. It doesn't work that way, right? So we have to figure out, well, what things are doable, what are not, what's not doable. And it's really, really important to, you know, meet patients where they're at and understand how to help them with what their resources are and what their abilities are. And that's different for everybody.
And do you find people are generally receptive?
Yes and no. And so, you know, I think what the important thing here is to understand what someone is able to do, because, you know, there's no expectation that someone's going to be making gourmet meals at home and just eating salads all day. That's absolutely not the intention here. But what the intention is that my goal as a physician, especially as a weight management specialist, is to help to decrease the intake of processed foods that are so, so prevalent around us. And I think that is one of the key reasons why our diabetes and obesity epidemics are so, so out of control. And there's no stopping right now. And that's why I don't think one medication is going to fix this. It's going to be how we understand how to eat.
Yes. And I'm wondering just culturally in this country, why it is that way versus other countries.
Yeah, you know, I think the emphasis and prevalence of processed foods are, it's just everywhere. You know, it's convenient. Everyone wants a quick fix, just like they want a quick fix with the weight. People want a quick fix or easy access to a good meal and a satisfying meal. And so I think part of it is the way that we understand, you know, just our eating patterns and everything. And this is generational. This is not something that's going to be fixed, you know, in the next couple months, but it's really something where, you know, it starts with children. It starts with our families. It starts with understanding, you know, these are the things that I should be buying at the store. These are the things I should probably avoid. This is how often I should probably eat out or not eat out. And this is how I can put together, you know, a dietary pattern low in processed foods to help prevent, you know, weight gain and diabetes and heart disease and, you know, all the things that happen metabolically from a diet that is emphasized in, you know, a high intake of processed foods.
With your patients, what is the, I'm sure everybody's different, but is there a tipping point for you or under, so you have two patients, both of whom are obese. Maybe, is there a difference between how you might approach using Ozempic or Wegovy for one versus the other?
Well, you know, the dosing is similar, you know, and the thing is, like, some patients may do really well and start having weight loss at lower doses, whereas others, you may need to use higher doses, but that's definitely dependent on the patient. But again, the one thing to really emphasize is that, hey, you know, what does your day-to-day look like? Because, you know, we have patients that are struggling with diabetes and weight that travel for work, that don't have access to, you know, readily healthy foods. We have others that have, you know, a full, you know, availability of being able to cook and shop and all of that, you know, that kind of regular lifestyle. And so we have to, again, figure out how do we make it work for both parties, right? It may not be perfect, but we can certainly, little changes can lead to large, you know, changes in the future.
I guess I was wondering, do you start with lifestyle changes and then turn to medication?
I do.
When that doesn't work. Okay.
Yes. And so medication is never my fallback. Okay. If someone is kind of showing me that they're able to, you know, maintain a certain regular pattern of, you know, their activity and what they're eating, and they're consistent about it, that's when the medication is going to be the most effective. Because if we start medication at the get-go, and you know, again, this is all very individual,
right,
and it's important to speak to your doctor about your individual case. But what I have noticed, at least in my medical care, is that starting the medication without having those other discussions doesn't lead to the results that most people are looking for.
Well, Dr. Disha Narang, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Disha Narang is an endocrinologist at Northwestern Medicine Lake Forest Hospital. She specializes in obesity and culinary medicine. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. You've heard the advice. Drink a glass of pickle juice after a run. Eat a bowl of pasta before a marathon or a 5K to hone your personal record. Regular exercise is one thing. The contemporary barrage of food tips and tricks to optimize your workout is another. Alex Hutchinson covers science and fitness for Outside Magazine. His recent column talks about insights for fueling for endurance sports. We'll post a link to that at WOSU.org/allsides. Alex Hutchinson, welcome back.
Thanks, Ann. It's good to be back.
So carbs are important, right?
Well, it's not such an obvious question, right? Because they've gone through a tough PR decade, let's say.
Right.
But yeah, I would say that I can say with more confidence than I would have said 5 or 10 years ago that yes, carbs are important for endurance sports. For, you know, there's bigger questions about health and things like that. But if you want to run a marathon, the research is stronger than ever that that carbs are important.
What are carbs doing that gives you the endurance you seek?
Well, you can burn any kind of food to make energy to fuel for your muscles, but different macronutrients have different properties. And fat is a very good fuel for endurance. And we have, most of us have lots and lots and lots of fat available to burn, which is why it's good for very long endurance activities. What's special about carbohydrates is that you can access them at a very high rate. You can burn them quickly. And so if you want to do anything more than sort of a brisk walk, you can't keep up for the most part with just fat. So you need to be able to access your carbs, but carbohydrates are, you don't carry as much carbohydrate with you as you do fat. Hmm. And so there's a constant push and pull between, I need to use carbs if I want to run or bike or hike up a mountain, but I can't just rely on having them stored the way I can with fat.
Interesting. How important is the timing of carb intake for performance? Is that what you were getting at, that you can, you know, they say the night before?
Yeah, timing is important precisely because we can only carry, rough rule of thumb might be you can carry about 20 miles worth of carbohydrates, or call it 20 miles of carbohydrates, which for a 26 mile marathon, that means you have to be topping up, not just right before the race, but also during the race. But even for, let's say you're running a 10K, one of the sort of most interesting streams of recent research is that unlike your car, your car can drive perfectly well with a half full tank of gas. Your muscles don't work so well with a half full tank of carbohydrates. And so you'll start to fatigue or tire when your carbohydrate stores are partly depleted. So that's why you need to say, like the day before an endurance event, you want to make sure your carbohydrates are topped up. And then even right before you start, you know, the morning of, you need to refill your carbohydrates. Right before you start an endurance event, you want to also, and maybe even during, depending on the length of the event.
Is there a type of carb that is better for that right before the event time than not?
Yeah, I mean, and this is where you have to distinguish between performance advice and health advice.
Okay.
The best carbohydrates for quick and easy digestion and quick access for sports are kind of the worst carbohydrates for long-term health.
Okay.
And so, yeah, basically it's sugar. Sugar is what you want during or immediately before exercise. And so that's one of the reasons there's been pushback against things like, you know, sports drinks, Gatorade. It's like, they're not health foods. Like, let's not confuse ourselves. They're perfectly fine if you're consuming the amount that you're going to then burn during exercise. But if you're using them just because, like, hey, it's Tuesday afternoon and I'm thirsty, that's not good because you're drinking sugar. These are not like special healthy carbohydrates. It's sugar.
And the trade-offs are worth it for serious runners, or are there certain kinds of carbohydrates for serious runners that are more healthy than, say, you know, the Gatorade?
Again, I think it's worth distinguishing between what you eat on a day-to-day basis,
gotcha,
your diet, and what you consume at the start line or halfway through a competitive sports event. And I think most athletes, and the more serious they are, the more carefully they consider what kinds of foods they eat. And so they'd want to eat, you know, you want to get carbohydrates from whole grains and vegetables and sources like that. And if you're getting them from fruits, you want to get them from fruits, not from juices, for example. And that's the lifestyle advice. The, you know, halftime of the soccer game advice is sugar water, and that, you know, there's different kinds of sugar. There is a whole industry that looks at, well, if we take, instead of just sugar, if we take a combination of glucose and fructose in a precise ratio of 2:1, that allows us to absorb sugar into the bloodstream more quickly. And that's been an area of substantial and exciting research, which I think has helped increase performances in the last decade. And you know, there's also fancy things like a hydrogel sports drink, where you drink it, and it can be hard to swallow a lot of sugar during a hard exercise. So the sugar is encapsulated in something called a hydrogel, which effectively hides the sugar from your stomach, so you don't get an upset stomach. Then it passes into your digestive system and is absorbed. So there's lots of fancier ways of getting sugar in, but at the core, it's still just sugar.
I'm talking with Alex Hutchinson. He's Outside Magazine's Sweat Science columnist. He's a fitness writer and author. We're talking about you know, carbs and workouts. How do you know in a long run whether it's 10? Well, anything over a 3K would be, I mean, a 5K would be long for me, but a 10 or a marathon or a half marathon or anything like that, how do you know or when you need help?
Well, one distinction I would make is between, let's say, a race where you're trying to maximize your performance and a training run where you're out there to get fitter. And the goal isn't necessarily to go as fast as possible. The goal is to challenge your body and get fitter. So I personally, you know, I would never take any sort of sports drink or any sort of carbohydrates in any run less than about 2 hours.
Okay.
Now, some people would be a little more aggressive than that. And in some sense, it's sort of the nutritional equivalent of wearing a weighted vest or something like that. You're teaching your body to access those fat stores, which we talked about earlier, the better your body can get better at accessing those fat stores. And so I would say in the context of training and fitness, you don't necessarily want to be overemphasizing refueling. But if, you know, there comes a point where you want to be comfortable, you want to be safe, and so warning signs to look for are things like feeling a little lightheaded, a little woozy. That's certainly, and if you're out there for a few hours, it depends. Again, let's say you get up first thing in the morning and you're going to go for a very long run, your carb stores will have been depleted overnight, and you maybe won't have had a big meal in quite a while. That's one thing compared to if you go to a workout at 3 in the afternoon and you've had a good breakfast and a good lunch, then you're going to be reasonably fully stocked. So I would be more conscious of taking in some carbs during a long workout first thing in the morning if I haven't had a good breakfast.
You've written about how vegetables are overrepresented when we think about training foods. What do you mean by that? How so?
Yeah, this was an interesting point I heard from, I was at a conference recently, and a sports nutritionist, one of the leading ones in the world named Jennifer Saigo, was making this very unexpected point, which is that sometimes you need to tell people to eat fewer vegetables. And it wasn't her point that she wasn't saying that vegetables are bad. Vegetables are very, 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 very good. And we should all eat, in general, more vegetables for the most part. But if you're, let's say you're doing a lot of exercise, and so the number of calories you need to eat in a given day depends on how much exercise you're doing. So if you're doing a ton of exercise, you need to get a ton of calories. And if you look at what the U.S. Olympic Committee recommends for people who are, for serious athletes who are in heavy training periods, they actually say you need to kind of dial down the vegetable content. And it sort of reminds me of those Seinfeld episode where Elaine orders the big salad and everyone talks about the big salad. And what Jennifer Saigo said is like, you have to kind of be careful with the big salad because you feel like you're eating an enormous meal. The right. Salad takes up like half the table, and you're chewing for, 90 minutes, but you don't actually get that many calories. So this is only a concern if you're doing a pretty heavy training load and trying to get in a lot of calories. But I think it's in endurance sports, underfueling is a serious problem because there's body image issues. People get disordered eating in a lot of cases when they're sports like running have a serious problem with that. And so sometimes you see athletes who are like, no, I'm eating lots. Look, I ate this salad. It's like, three bowls of salad. That's like, yeah, but the three bowls of salad only had like 200 calories in it. And even though you were chewing for a long time, you didn't get it in. So that's something to just, a sort of unexpected twist to the nutrition.
Interesting. And iron is an issue for an endurance athletes. Why is that?
Yeah, there's a few different factors. It used to be that people thought the main thing was that, let's say you're running, every time your feet hit the ground, you're squeezing your blood vessels. And so you're rupturing blood vessels and losing iron. And that's called foot strike hemolysis. And it is a thing. But more recently, what people have realized is there's a hormone called hepcidin that's produced during intense exercise, which actually blocks the absorption of iron. So low iron is extremely common among runners and other endurance athletes. And a lot of runners, they end up on iron supplements. But even those iron supplements don't necessarily help if you're taking them, or iron-rich foods. They don't necessarily help if you're taking them right before or right after a heavy workout. So you want to take your iron supplements. We already know you want to take iron supplements not with a meal. Now we also know you want to take them not within 6 hours of a hard workout.
As far as how to manage in cold weather, does the dietary needs change, or do the dietary needs change?
Well, it's true that keeping your body warm does take energy. I mean, it's actually also true that keeping your body cool takes energy if you're during the middle of summer too. So it's not all that different. You may need to eat a little bit more to cover your caloric needs if you're spending 2 hours outside going for skiing or whatever the case may be. It's not ultimately the basic needs are the same. It's just that you're going to be burning a few extra calories to keep the body warm. And the good thing about exercise in the cold weather is that your body is, your muscles are about 25% efficient. Every time you burn a calorie, 25% of it goes to moving your muscles, and 75% is heat, just like in the internal combustion engine of a car. So that heat will keep you warm just by without wasting any extra energy.
You know, we're just about out of time, but I wanted you to talk about sodium too, just a bit.
Excuse me. Yeah. So the quick message on sodium is, it's been part of sports drinks like Gatorade ever since they were formulated. And it's true that we lose sodium when you sweat. But the latest research is building a pretty strong case that you can get in virtually all situations, except for maybe really long ultra marathons or Ironman triathlons, you'll get the sodium you need from your food. and you can rely on your taste. If you're craving salt, if you're craving potato chips, get some salt. But you don't need to worry about whether your sports drink has a special salt supplement in it.
Alex Hutchinson, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ann.
Alex Hutchinson is Outside Magazine's Sweat Science columnist. He's a fitness writer and author. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for joining us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.